Okay, folks, I stopped with the garage, and I'm going to ask you to get, I hand out the sheet of the garage out and ask you to guess what the professional said. I'll give you a little more information. On the sixth day, it passed something unusual, but its creation says that it's built in the hole. I believe you phrase, once you understand the tone, and the hole itself is good, Lord is buried, God has to have the same soul, but we'll never have the same soul in the hole. The rabbis, as you know, any of you have done see it's running all rabbinic and midrashic in the center of the Tanakh, know that that sets us off. There's a pattern, the pattern is broken, that means there's additional meaning that is being transmitted to us. The rabbis want to know, what is the old find in Dallas? And if any rabbis are aware, there are a lot of things that aren't described being created. There's a lot of things that we know around us, but we don't see the created elements, wind, fire. So the rabbis figured that totally obvious there was an additional creation that weren't told of that. So if you know the answer, don't say it, because then it'll ruin it for everyone else. But if you don't know the answer, what do you think that was actually described that could be told in the old? Any guesses?
Shabbat?
Well, I guess Shabbat, and I guess that's It was created. Well, yes, sorry, please. Yes, all right. You're on the right track.
Man was created.
Judaism. Judaism, Torah. Another nice guess. We'll see the answer to the first four.
Through the default.
Let's go against the heart.
What's the answer? Everything else is only good?
Very good is death. Okay, sure, that's what the text only was said if you were living in Pantarella. Okay, and you probably know there's another discussion on the rabbis whether it was better to be created or not be created, and the answer is better not to be created. Right? So, yeah, perhaps it's a little bit of pessimism going on over there, but it didn't get any urgency for me. The rabbis had something in mind when they said this. And there's a beautiful explanation, something that was beautiful to me, in the second source in front of you. I sort of ran here, so I might have to volunteer. You want to volunteer to read the source. I don't usually do that. But anyway, thank you very much.
The intention is not only about human death, but rather also more generally about the loss and destruction of all things found in the world. The explanation of the Midrash is that were everything in the world not to wither and end, people would not toil toward perfection, meaning that, since everything would last forever, they would not attempt to recreate a thing anew or to seek its perfection. Since that is the case, everything new that we see in the world stems from the loss and the end of the thing that preceded it. So, every generation completes the forces of creation, and this is truly very good Tov Me'od.
This is Rebbe from A.B. Epstein, who's a fairly recent commentator. Recent means he died in World War II in the Holocaust, actually. And it's interesting for a variety of reasons, which we're not having time to focus on right now, but his commentary to Torah is called Torah Tumima. And this is his interpretation of the Midrash, which, again, to me, is a beautiful idea. In the United States, we have an expression, I never know whether an expression is American or English or Spanish cultural. We have an expression, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Right? You have that over here?
Yeah.
If it's not broken, don't fix it. I would imagine the English would be more traditional, but it's not broken, don't fix it. It's not a monarchy. I imagine that there's a truth to this, that we, especially as we grow older in our whole life,
we're used to doing things a certain way, right? And often young people thinking in their ways because they don't all know the way that we've been doing things is not there, and therefore they check out other possibilities. And that's another way of saying the world progresses. And progress, well, we'll see, perhaps a good thing. And that's how we get to Darwin. Or perhaps that's how Darwin gets to us, I'm not sure. We'll speak about that as we go on. The point of the talk is really a short little book of Kittle, which we'll get to. And the fact that in that book you'll see the Rabbi Cook, which I'm going to try to point Cook, who hopefully all of you have heard about, but just on half the book. He was the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Palestine before the state of Israel. There had been one chief rabbi that was usually Sephardi, but when the British came, they also opened up a second office, the office of Ashkenazic chief rabbi. He was the first one. He was uncanny for being able to unify all sorts of things, including all sorts of Jews, all sorts of ideas. And if you haven't investigated some of his work, it's truly, truly worthwhile. And I had a much smaller audience in my family cast than anybody they went there. There was a much, much smaller group. And I'll explain the personal relationship I have with that specific text, but it is truly a richest experience to look through the works of Rav Kook. In any case, Rav Kook was very excited about evolution. Right? We're sort of surprised to hear about Orthodox rabbis, one thing to begrudgingly say, it's true. But another thing to be excited about evolution. And that's exactly what Rav Kook was, in fact, excited about evolution. And in order to understand why, I want to give a bit of background to what we're really talking about. Darwin's, to put him into context in terms of our discussion, probably most of you don't need this, so maybe it's a good review. Darwin comes in the midst of a particular way of looking at the world. But we all mentioned the word progress, and progress is really the word that interests us the most. Progress is not a universal idea. In other words, men and women didn't always believe that things get better as time goes on. Quite the opposite in classical period. Things were viewed as cyclical. Person is born, goes through things and dies, that cycle is repeated, it's repeated with society, there's war, there's tragedies, things go on the same way they've always been. Okay, that's the way classical man looked at himself and his society. Come the Enlightenment, just optimism that grows out of the Renaissance, and there's a new optimism about the possibility of transforming society, and certainly a new way of looking at the world around oneself. That hits its pinnacle, really, in the 19th century, in the century where Darwin was working. And what he does, this type of view helps him, like we're all shaped by ideas around us. The way we look at things, the way our society looks at things, helps us focus on specific issues that we're dealing with in certain ways. And I know that after Darwin was influenced by this, and looking to what he saw in the laboratory, and noticing that things seem to change in what we might call positive ways, certainly in toward complexity, right? The simple organisms develop, and hopefully, if we can make a value judgment that they come to creatures like man, which hopefully is something positive and advanced over the amoeba. And so this concept is integrated into science. This is something that Hegel, the same century, the famous German philosopher, does in history, speak about and identify the notion of progress in history. And something that was done before them, earlier, but in the same type of mindset in economics by a year old Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, the idea of the invisible hand that helps things come together and progress. In any case, whether that's a good description or not is not so important. Hopefully it is. Well, what is important is what Levcook saw in all of this. Why, you know, it's interesting that of all the ideas he could have picked on economics, he could have picked on history, but he specifically focuses on evolution instead of the other examples of progress. I would say, and certainly in hindsight, where the other areas are more questioned on some level, philosophy is always, humanity is always more room for discussion, for give and take, science is as much more real and tangible, it's much more difficult to disprove the fact that Darwin was able to put together around the theory. Perhaps that's why Cook preferred this as opposed to the other manifestations of progress. Perhaps he wanted to shock us, I don't know, that's not the reason. But in any case, Cook focuses on that. Now it is true, as I said before, or I alluded to before, that those of you who study philosophy or humanities in general know that there's a crisis of faith already after the First World War and certainly after the Second World War in the notion of progress. People wonder whether, in fact, that we're really moving in a positive direction, right? After the catastrophe of the past century, that was a very open question in philosophy, and many people, in fact, questioned the notions of Hegel. Hegel certainly fell into disfavor, and socialist theories questioned the application of this in economics as well. No doubt the theory of progress has been questioned on some level. By the same token, there's more than one contemporary philosopher, and certainly in political philosophy, and Hegel has made somewhat of a comeback. I would say that just intuitively, in our own consciousness, in modern consciousness, and when we think about the way society is moving, we generally intuit that yes, in spite of all the problems, the society is generally moving forward. And if we question that in certain areas, there's certain areas that are very hard to debate, certainly in the areas of medicine, and more generally in technology and science. It's very difficult to argue with longer lives, with wealthier lives, not necessarily better lives, but it's clear that we wouldn't trade off what we have in terms of the accumulation of information that seems to progress in a positive direction. So again, whether that's true or not, I'm personally very attracted to contemporary philosophy, to a book. You don't have to be. I'm presenting it as one particular approach to life, a particular approach to Torah, and you'll see if you like it or not, and we can talk about it soon. In any case, I want to just clarify one thing before we go further. Some of you might have an objection and say that in the Jewish tradition, the notion of progress seems to be just the opposite. It's all clear that we have reverence for our ancients. We look up to the prophets, the Moshe Rabbeinu. There's no greater man than Moshe Rabbeinu. We look up to the rabbis. I had a discussion the first day with someone, I don't think they're in the audience, about the notion of reverence for the Talmud. Talking about the importance, certainly in orthodoxy, of having to root your thinking within the Talmudic tradition. That means that if you think otherwise from the Talmud, at least in orthodoxy, I'm saying what it is, again, you can like it or dislike it, just the way it is, that you have to address what the rabbis say in the Talmud. You can disagree, but you have to explain and justify your disagreement. You can't simply bypass it and say, I know better. That doesn't work within traditional Jewish stuff. Okay? So you might object, since we have so much reverence for the ancients, how can we speak of progress? In fact, there's really regression. The great were greater, we left it. And there's even a concept some of you might have heard of called the reduction of the world. And I heard that expression before a couple people. The reduction of the world means that the generations get smaller and smaller as time goes on. Okay? It's not a concept that's agreed to by everyone, but be that as it may, the popular concept that's thrown around. Nonetheless, Whereas Cooper was very much enamored with the notion of progress, was aware of such a notion, was aware of reverence for the ancients, who still felt that progress not only is legitimate, but is intrinsic to Judaism, as we'll see shortly. I want to take another source before we get to the book, and possibly explain that through this source. And that's the Gemara in Nachos, and certainly has the English and not the Hebrew. Nachos on page 29b as follows, a beautiful midrash. God said to Moshe, there's a man who lived in the end of several generations, and Akiva the Yosef is his name, right? Rabbi Akiva. Show that Rabbi Akiva. It says he will in the future interpret mountains and mountains of laws from every single crown on the letters of the Torah. The Moshe said, show it to me. He said to him, so God said to him, turn around. And he conjured Rabbi Akiva, he time traveled, I don't know how he did it, he showed him Rabbi Akiva. The Moshe was in Rabbi Akiva's yeshiva, and then he was incognito, what he looked like. In any case, Moshe went and sat at the back of eight rows and didn't know what they were saying. Right? He's in the yeshiva where they're studying the Torah, which Moshe has just given him, and they're having this argument. Moshe has no idea what's flying. His strength was set in the spirit of what he saw. One thing which another matter, when Akiva student said to him, how do you know this? They asked him, how do you know this form? And he said to them, as a halakha from Moshe, he received a tina, at which point Moshe was rude. And it's cute, right? He gets his strength back, he has his name, he's mentioned, he feels good, but on some of those extremely deep drops, saying that it's true that essentially Rabbi Akiva knew that Moshe didn't know. Now, another reason trying to set up is Moshe knows, I'm the best, right? He's very modest, but he also knows he's been a golden, right? He's the best. And all of a sudden, there's this Rabbi Akiva saying all sorts of things he doesn't know what he's saying. What's the answer? The answer is, it's his story. Meet whatever he's his story. Rabbi Akiva has the advantage of having a Moshe Rabbeinu before him, right? Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have the advantage of having Rabbi Akiva before him, after they were considered. Moshe would have known what was going on. Put it a different way, then says that we are like midges standing on the shoulders of giants. So it's not to deny that they were greater. On some level, that's the way we look at our sages, the way we look at our ancients, anyone who studies the Talmud, understands why we have awe for these people. Teacher of Wittgenstein once quoted, I forget which American Supreme Court Chief Justice, 100 years back, who was speaking about the Constitution as final because right and right because final. Wittgenstein said we apply that to our sages as well. But be that as it may, even if they're greater than us, we have the advantage that we know what they said. And that is obviously, an important building block of progress. And as progress is a group effort, it's the coming together of generations that only works in one direction, that only works forward, doesn't work backward. Now, Rav Kook didn't need all of this. Presumably, he also needed this. But for Rav Kook, this was an idea that was obvious in the Kabbalah, in the study of mystical Judaism. We'll read the quote now, and I'll explain what I mean. This is a central quote in Orach HaKodesh. The book speaks in more than one place, by the way, about evolution. It's not just one lonely quote. He clearly was very enthused about it. And he says as follows, in the middle source, the foot in Orach HaKodesh. Evolution, he says, has a greater affinity with the Kabbalah than all other philosophies. Evolution is the closest thing possible. Why? Evolution, which proceeds on a course of improvement, offers us the basis of optimism in the world. How can we despair when we realize that everything evolves and improves? I had an answer. Now, Rav Kook didn't need Darwin to tell him that. As far as Rav Kook is concerned, the Kabbalah already tells him that. And I have very little knowledge of the Kabbalah. But I know a little bit in terms of how it helps me to understand Rav Kook, who is very much immersed
in Kabbalah. There's a question that many people ask, especially Jewish ministers, and that is, why did God make created world? And due for the question, we discussed it late at night, and one of these questions that doesn't have easy answers. God is perfect. He's perfect. Why does he need to create something that's not perfect? So according to what I've understood or heard in Kabbalah, that's precisely the point. That God only has one type of perfection, and that's static perfection. It's called in Hebrew, Shleimut. Shleimut, which is the static existence of perfection. That's what God is. But he's lacking something else. Right, he's lacking a process of perfection. What we call in Hebrew, or the Hispael form of the word, the flexive form of the verb, he's shtalu, getting perfect. Right, he's already perfect, he can't become perfect, he stays perfect. So he created a world in order to become perfect. Okay? Obviously a deep topic, I'm not sure exactly what it means, if it matches like it, if it's like it, but that's what apparently the mystical tradition says. So for Kuk, when Darwin comes along and others like him and seek progress in the world, this is a certification by the secular world, which for Kuk in general was very excited about. He felt that all sorts of truth was coming out of the secular world. He appreciated the advances of science as well as the advances of human thought, to the point that he even appreciated new ideas in other religions. Just looking at Anthony this afternoon, where he said there are new points of light coming in his time through other religions. So Rav Kook is very excited about what he sees as a certification of what he felt we Jews have known all along, that the world progresses, not only in terms of the Jewish mission, hopefully we're coming closer to but also in the world around us, in human institutions, but perhaps for a book, it's even more impressive and more touching to see it in the world itself, in God's creation. It could be that the reason. That a book is more excited about evolution than any other thing. Because evolution is just an explanation of what he sees as God's world. And it's actually working. Someone's found out, finally, how God's plan is working on a physical level in the very physical world. And for us, as I said, that's very exciting. Okay. That's the first part. That's what Cook is excited about. Congress, that's the first part of the topic, right? The first two things on your list are Cook and Darwin, Darwin and Cook. So what about the free market of ideas? What does that have to do with progress? So we mentioned economics before, capitalist economics. And for better or worse, we enjoy the fruits of what we call a free market economy. A free market economy is not just a free-for-all. There's a theory behind it. There's a method to the madness. And the theory, again, going way back to Adam Smith, in spite of all sorts of rectification and inundation, essentially says that a market has a certain sort of blind intelligence, meaning just like species, we have only the fittest surviving, and that on some level is good, it's orderly. So too with products. Products too don't survive if they're not fit to pass the standard of the market. So that generally that the cheapest, or through a different way, the best product at the lowest cost will generally be the one that survives. Granted, there's differentiation, this brand, that brand, all sorts of things, but you can't sell a product that nobody wants. Or, differently, you can't sell a product, at least over the long term. You can't sell a product for twice the price that someone else can sell it. And even if you're the first one there, someone else can replicate the product. If you're selling it for much more than someone else can make it for, it's not going to stand.
These are laws of free market economics. Let's give you a couple of examples, probably not necessarily on health of many throughout all life. I remember learning you the existence of something called a typewriter. Sure, some of you are old enough to remember what that is. I think I saw it recently in a museum that along with dial telephone to make us all here old, so I remember both of these antiquities. In any case, I remember when there was competition between typewriters and the new invention was coming to become a household item, and that was the PC, or in specific terms, the word processor. And at first it was, you know, people used the typewriter and certainly less expensive than a word processor. But as time went on, the market simply faced the possibility of anyone buying it off the map. It was simply any antiquity collectors and so on and so forth. And you know, so a couple of sugar dads who have to have a typewriter or whatever invention it is. In any case, the market fell. Again, invisible. There's no decision. There wasn't a public decision to ban typewriters. It was the invisible hand of the market that shows what was clearly, in retrospect, a better product. Okay, or if some of you remember, yeah, the other products are simply passing fast that society realizes it doesn't work. When we said the electric blanket, that wasn't like, it's really a small gift, the electric blanket. Electric blanket was something that had coils inside the blanket. Some people are fascinated with an electric blanket. Sure, some things were involved in other technological museums. That coils in it. And that way, you give you additional heat right in your own bed. Okay? So people realize that besides being a little dangerous having electrical wires inside your bed sheet, it wasn't particularly useful or comfortable, and it was the way of all things. For another,
by the way, because of central heating.
Oh, sorry.
Went away because of central heating.
Is that a grammar word?
Sure, that is by the way, because of
central heating. I left. The
fixture,
did that under heating?
Not under heating.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm not sure
you're ready
for that.
Central heating was replaced.
Okay. For America.
For America.
Another example, excuse me first for giving you some examples, it's a lot of fun. another short-lived item that went on our market in the United States, I don't know if it was here at all, if it was here longer, was a car called the Yugo. Just the Yugo. Okay, you probably know where the Yugo was made, right? Yugo was made in Yugoslavia. I should make fun of them because eventually they also made a car for a short period of time. Well, very good. The Yugo came to the United States was tremendous in the 70s. Tremendous PR campaign. This is going to be the next Volkswagen. It's small and much and half the price of the Volkswagen. But of course, you only got a 3-month warranty. There was a reason for that. After 3 months, that was the end of the talk. So Yugo also went the way of all things. And the truth is, in free market thinking, it's not only good for the consumer who wants the best, cheapest product, it's also good for the producer. Because when Yugoslavians realize they can't compete in car making, they're going to seek the best natural economic advantage, like making cheese or something. Whatever it is, they're going to find it. And all nations, presumably all people, have something they're better at than others, and they find a way, as a result of this invisible hand, to do the things that's most valuable for them, based on their potential, and most valuable for society. Obviously, there's change, and we know in terms, we're seeing long term, the short term, people suffer. And that's one of the socialist critiques of the market economics. But in the long term for society as a whole, again, unless you're ideologically socialistic, for society as a whole, it tends to work, which is why one of the reasons, at least, it's so popular and getting more popular in the world at large. Okay. Now, that brings us from one area of the free market to another area of the free market.
And we do think a lot of comparisons from one realm to other realms. But as I said before, this all comes from a certain way of thinking, which is rooted in, first of all, in enlightenment, particularly in 19th century thought. So using the free market as our metaphor, a notion has become popular in modern times, called the free market of ideas, with the same notion that society has some sort of indivisible hand, which determines the best ideas. If ideas compete, the ideas that are not fit to survive eventually wither away, and the ideas that are superior maintain themselves. That's what's called the free market of ideas. And in a sense, when communism prevented information from going through the Iron Curtain, so the sense was that they were afraid of this free market. They weren't willing to compete because they realized that their ideas were inferior. Now, obviously, communism had a defense to that and disagreed with the whole notion. But be that as it may, that's the type of thinking behind this notion. So the question is, what does Judaism do with it? What does Judaism do about this free market? Do we welcome it? Do we fight against it? Do we raise an iron curtain of our own? And it's important to realize that there's no natural affinity, at least classically, in terms of Judaism, with this notion of a free market of ideas. What do I mean by that? I think the closest concept in Judaism to finding out what else is around is something you see in Pirkei Avot, which says, you should know what to say to someone, you should know the answer you can give to a heretic. In other words, you have to know enough of that heresy to be able to give them a good answer. But the fact that that's in Pirkei Avot tells us that that wasn't really addressed to everyone. Right? Anybody know who Pirkei Avot is addressed to, according to the Rambam? Sorry? No? The Lamas, right. In other words, the judges, two experts, the people who are likely to encounter ideological opposition. In other words, it's a very practical idea that you're going to encounter some opposition on the margin, and on the margins you have to be ready to be able to say something intelligent. Because if you don't, then it's going to seep inward. But the rabbis on some level represent some sort of not iron curtain, some sort of tin curtain, if you want, that prevents ideas from coming in and out. With the understanding that most people, at least in their time, were felt to be incapable of addressing all sorts of other ideas, or simply uninterested. There's completely two separate realms. Jews are not interested in foreign ideas. Now we're going back 2,000 years. The major ideologies are essentially pagan. Right? So it's not something the Jewish tradition has a tremendous amount of respect for. And therefore, the more you can keep it away, the happier it is. So that's classical period, times of change. And my friend, Professor Elie Malamud, in Canada, you might have heard of him, once made a beautiful observation that encapsulated the notion of how unsheltered the most sheltered Jews are today. He said that in Yashar, which we think of as the most sheltered, it's probably more sheltered for us. It's pretty sheltered as far as Jewish society goes in Jerusalem. He says that it's really like a 2-minute drive from Yashar, like 10-minute walk from there to Rehov Yaakov, the center of modern Jerusalem. And everybody who lives in Yashar knows it's that far. There's very little segregation of ideas. A religious student, no matter how isolated his parents try to keep him, is exposed to the modern world. And if there's a computer at home with internet, then all the more so. Many people, again, even the most segregated segments of Orthodox society,
feel that they need, at least for business reasons, to have access to the internet, which is a trend, by the way, that's only going to intensify. That, again, you can survive on a typewriter for only a certain amount of time. I think the same is true in business. You can survive in any type of serious business without the internet for only a certain amount of time, and that becomes more and more difficult as time goes on. So we are exposed to the free market of ideas, whether we like to or not. And on that level, even on the defensive side, you can say that though the principle of answering our opponents was addressed to rabbis only, that's because the rabbis only were the ones that had to deal with it. Now we have to deal with it. Like it or dislike it, probably can see it as an opportunity or as a temptation or as a challenge, but we all have to deal with competing ideologies. I just whenever I speak about competing ideologies, I think about two people who went two different ways. It's already almost 100 years ago. I was in a class discussion earlier this week about Franz Rosenzweig. Franz Rosenzweig is someone who encountered the free market of ideas, and we feel shows great. He became an observant Jew, right? A highly complex Jewish Jew, but that thing was assimilated, not only assimilated, but on the verge of converting out to Christianity. But there's another European intellectual about the same time period who made the opposite move, one called Simon Weil in France, also a Jewish intellectual, also close to Christian, in her country, Catholic intellectual circles, who didn't quite convert to Catholicism, but considered herself a Christian as she moved on in the world. So, there's another the politician was also just talking about this. That the one I'm referring to is a philosopher who died young, who wrote quite a few things. It's very difficult writing, but quite well known. He died actually in Britain in the middle of the war. In any case, but the example is not that important. The point is that especially Jews were assimilated, but the truth is the most segregated and unassimilated Jews are also involved in the market of ideas. And that's simply the reality. What is what kind of reality is it? If it's not a reality of choosing, is it a positive feature of contemporary society for us as Jews, or is it a negative feature of contemporary society for us as Jews? And my thinking is that following the ideas of Rabkook, that progress is something that happens whether we're aware of it or not as an evolution. But this too might be viewed as a positive development. That this free market of ideas that puts us on the spot and that swallows up some of our people. If you're in competition, you're not going to win every time. Technological improvements, right? there's a cost. And I've argued in other books, in other contexts, I've argued that life, in any context, any serious interaction with life, is a series of trade-offs. We're constantly involved. Serious life is not something where everything's done for you and you get all the best possibilities. And the best of all possible worlds is in itself a tremendous trade-off. Like the possible world, as opposed to ideal world. We live in a possible world. A world that makes sense, a world that makes sense involves trade-offs. So that is correct. The world of choice, a free market of ideas involves cost. There are many Jews in an organization called Jews for Jesus around the world. That's one of the costs. There are Jews who are Buddhists, quite a few, and that's also a cost.
In spite of all that, I would say, as far as I can read history, and obviously I'm not a prophet, I could be wrong. As far as I read history, from a Hegelian, Hookean perspective, in the aggregate, this is a positive thing. And I'll tell you why. When you compete with others, you have to put up your best effort. In my world, he's actually studying someone else. He was quoted by Rabbi Lamb, and also Rabbi Cardoza quoted Rabbi Lamb, who was quoting Ma Rao, who was quoting someone else. But it's a good quote. It's on a fifth level quote. It's in the Dera Dola. Dera Dola says, Ma Rao says that if you have an ideological opponent, don't tell them to be quiet. Don't tell them to be quiet. Don't say to them, don't argue with them. I don't want to hear it. Don't tell them that. Instead, you should tell them, I want to hear your best argument. I want to hear your best argument. On Sunday, I gave a critique of Rabbi Sachs in particular areas, various political thought. My intention was very similar, that if you want to develop thinking, it has to be through argumentation. In other words, how are we going to develop the best product possible if all we have are yes men? If everybody agrees with us, then we don't progress, we don't move forward, and we don't present our best face. And the famous Gemara, Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan, famous one of the greatest scholars of the Talmud, he had a Rukta, who actually was born a thief, whole interesting discussion, same as Reish Lakish. And Reish Lakish was very, because he was brown, because of his past, was very combative. He was brilliant, like Rabbi Yochanan, who was very combative. Rabbi Yochanan discovered that this would be a great study partner. And indeed, they studied for many years together. Rabbi Yochanan was overjoyed. One day, by according to the story from Rabbi Frost, remember Reish Lakish died. So Rabbi Yochanan had to get another study partner, which he did. And Rabbi Yochanan would say over his position, and study partner would say, beautiful, that's great, that's right. Yeah. He would say something else, oh, how wonderful, beautiful. So at the end of the day, Rabbi Yochanan was playing at his ear, what do you mean? And he's shaking him by the shoulders, what do you mean it's beautiful? I want you to argue with me. Why? Because you don't get anywhere. If people are just saying yes, yes, yes. That's the notion behind Jewish learning. I often teach women more than men, and my critique is women have roots and they're too nice to each other. men are to fight in this conflict. For women, it's very nice that women are kind of people, and generally speaking, you know, to make any stereotypical generalization. But there's room for fighting. And the room, as far as Judaism is concerned, is specifically in the intellectual arena. That's how we become better. And my opinion is that this free market of ideas has forced us willy-nilly put forward our best possible understanding and explanation. And we're very far, we have a long way to go. And a lot of people are taking the cheap route of thinking that PR is a substitute, and bliss is a substitute for real critical thinking and new ways of looking at our tradition and text. But there's no way out. One way or another, sooner or later, we're going to have to answer the best arguments from other traditions. Answers aren't easy, right? Difficult road ahead of us. Not celebrating it by saying something easy, all we have to do is bring out the cheerleaders, let's go, and now the time to start, work up the engine, and we're going to win. It's a lot of work, like any important project.
a lot of work, that only some of the best that we have started upon. But I think it's there, I think it's a necessity. And the interaction is very interesting. The fact that people are going in both directions, from Jewish tradition, away from Jewish tradition, as well as backwards, has opened up, I think, Orthodox society to the understanding that it's not a community that can segregate itself anymore. It's a community that has to speak out. And again, some people are doing this very poorly. And it's going to take time for the community as a whole to catch up and catch on to what it needs to do. But I think the project has started. And certainly one thing that I'd like to think that I'm getting involved in, and many others I know as well. So the same way that there's an invisible hand in economics, according to Adam Smith, the same way there seems to be an invisible hand for Darwin in biological evolution, I would go along with Hegel and say that God is operative in human history as well, specifically in Jewish history in particular, and whether ideologically we approve of the free market or not, on some level we should recognize God's hand in it, appreciate it, and take it for all it's worth. Take what you get.
One of the problems if you're translating the idea of economic theory to the free market of ideas, in economic theory, one of the places where all the theory falls down in the practical world is what the economists call that they assume that everybody is acting rationally, and economic rationality, which means that if a TV costs 200 pounds at one shop and 195 pounds at the other shop, you're always going to go across town to save the 5 pounds there. In the same way that if something costs 10 pounds or 5 pounds, you'll go the same distance. Because £5 is a rational, you would value saving that £5. That's not a conceptual old-fashioned classical. Okay. Exactly. But what comes to that is in the idea of, if we look at the modern world of ideas, and when you put yourself out of the marketplace, and the idea that people get to choose modern ideology for themselves is also something new. You didn't have a choice a couple of years ago. Ideologies are imposed on you. We didn't have this back here, is that whilst it's very nice in Judaism, we have to, you have to have a rational argument. Everything has to be based on sort of, winning best arguments, as you say. But modern society is very much, the 5-minute attention and what's popular and what a simplistic argument or something that you like. If we bring it to like a Israel situation, the simplistic narrative of Israel being occupied and all that, this and the other, versus the complex arguments that fit with the history and everything else, people are still more likely to go with what we would consider the worst argument, but because it's simplistic and attractive, you can compare that to any kind of argument in anything in the marketplace. And what are your thoughts on that in terms of the risk of, yes, a marketplace for ideas is good, but at the same time, humans are not, naturally always going to go for the most rational thing and what's necessary to that. And people, by and large, go what's easiest and what they're inclined to sort of follow through with. It's often necessary to for that target.
First of all, any metaphor is bound to not be exact. That's number one. Number two, I try to be careful about speaking in the long term and generality. The notion is that, granted, a person may prefer going to Panasonic and say just out for some of this stuff. Sometimes you like the ad or whatever it is, or someone they spent on some better, they have a shield. But again, my illustration is that no one is going to buy, or very few people are going to buy a laser player instead of buying a stereo. Right? And there's a rationale for that. It's not simply because one is involved and one is not. Now, I try to transfer that over into the world of ideas. Does it always work, or does it always work in economic theater, as you pointed out? Does it always work in ideas? No. There's a certain amount of faith. I guess on some level it's a religious idea, and humanity
everything on some level is a religious idea in a sense, but it can't be completely proven. Right? My sense is that the simplistic ideas over time, even if they are held by larger enough people, that these ideas dissipate. You could argue that that's not true. But again, looking at the historical record, my experience is that it is in fact the case, and we have reason to be encouraged. Now, on a more practical level, that doesn't mean, well, you know, forget the simplistic arguments, they're going to wither away anyway, and you don't have to deal with it. As long as you say that in terms of how these conflicts, we have a problem here and now. Again, I think parallels economics. The fact that in the long term things work out doesn't mean that you don't take care of the hungry and the unemployed, that in the short term are crushed. So I think that what I'm thinking about is the larger picture. And in terms of the larger picture, my faith, my understanding and observation is that it does work. And if it does work, then it fits into the thinking of Cook. There's reason for optimism. Yes.
As a biologist and as a Jew, I'm very, very nervous about drawing a metaphor between Darwinism and anything in the moral sphere. That has a bad history. I think it misrepresents biology. It leads people to say biology is rubbish. We don't want that science because the way people think about it, you know, thinking that there's an invisible hand, oh, we don't need to care about climate change because the Earth will care about itself and it'll all work out in the end, you know, but particularly making a moral argument based on the physical, practical process, natural process of evolution. I mean, you know, that gets you very easily towards eugenics. It gets you very easily towards the incredibly bad set of conclusions about how to run your moral life. How do you address that kind of issue?
Okay, so at first I thought you were saying something else that I heard at the end. I'm going to address what I heard at the end before getting to the more important question. Just to put what I thought I heard at first, I'm not here to defend Darwin's theory. That's not my interest. I'm not a biologist. This theory is actually not really important. It fits into our scheme in terms of where Cook is coming from. Now, moral implications of Darwinism, you're right, called social Darwinism in the previous century, which people wanted to cheat other people, said we can do whatever we want because, after all, survival is fit. Hopefully that's not the type of argument. I don't think that the type of argument that Cook is making. Cook is not making a moral argument that we should operate as Darwinists, but rather an observation that this is, in fact, the way the world acts and behaves, the way society behaves, as well as the way he understood from Darwin, that this is the way the natural world operates also. He felt it was wonderful, that observation, and for him it was encouraging. It didn't tell him that there's certain things that we have to do. On the other hand, there are certain practical implications, which I am drawing on, and that is to perhaps more open-minded as developments that we might think of as negative for the Jewish people, encouraged again by the larger picture. This is one of the things that I find so exciting with Cook, is that Cook is always able to find the light and the harmony in places we might not be able to find that. For me, that's very inspiring. For others, it may be naive or whatever. For me, it's very inspiring. I think there's a practical lesson that I'm trying to draw out of it, is simply to have faith in the process, not, but again, without the notion that you have to get high in mind, because there is a caveat, but there is a long-term and a short-term, and we live in both. And we can look happily toward the long-term, but we have to deal practically with the short-term. Yes.
And sort of a follow-up. Of course, my mother's always more. You know, Adam Smith was an alien. So neither Darwinism nor Marxian ideology is really framed in terms of the idea of progress. In fact, it's very much anti-etymological. But from a purely Darwinian point of view, the cockroach just has evolved as human beings. And it's only a misunderstanding of evolution that was this tree of life. But I wonder, in terms of your own argument, do you really need the word progress and convention of progress. So would it be quite sufficient to say that Judaism inevitably develops and changes and finds itself and forms itself, often in interaction with other ideologies, period. And you really need this sort of idea of a trajectory of progress, this sort of Hegelian superimposition, was clearly a process of change and development and mutual interaction.
Right, okay.
What you get by adding progress to that whole really quite wonderful impact.
First of all, the presentation is too far. You can certainly chop off the second part in the first part. That's clear. My explanation is not to do that. Do I need to do part one or do part two? You don't have to. I think it makes it stronger if you are so inclined. How do you apply that way? And as far as, I try to be very careful with doing big ideas that one knows the idea, you can point out small problems with it. I'm dealing with an interpretation of Darwin that says that, a human being is more significant than an amoeba. I mean, there's a historical progression. And specifically not with the populace. But again, I think we're getting to the technicalities, which is not my point. I think there is such a line of thinking. It exists out of Yom HaZeot until this day. There are many secular thinkers, serious ones, who are Hegelian. That has tremendous appeal to me. For religious reasons, for those who it has appeal to, so you can put part one and part two together. For those who don't, you can put part two, or you don't like part two, you can put part one. If you want either part, well, sorry. Yeah.
I thought
that
progress was the understood like the Hebrew word hasher would be useful for what was meant. And because circumstances change, some ideas that are not suitable anymore or something self-made. They are not kosher anymore, they have to become suitable. So in that way, there is progress, but that is number two is probably better for number two situation. It's not better naturally.
Oh, that's a question. It's your position. And my presentation, and I think in verse 12, is that it's not just fitting. You're right. Certainly, it has to be fitting. That's the bottom line, the basic situation. If it's not fitting, then it's inappropriate not to share it. The question to stop the discussion is, does it actually get better also? And my contention is that it is.
Yeah. Stop talking. I'm alluding to concept that you have a problem. I mentioned about from that book, 2019, which in a sense is almost quite a complete reversal of that, because you've got Moshe the greatest, but knows the whole Torah. And then you get, in the time of Rabbi Akiva, where they look at the minutiae. So he can't, and in a sense, science today and progress today is exactly the same. If a scientist today looked at the work of Leonardo da Vinci, who was a polymath and knew all science, impossible to say. Now, the reason I'm saying that is that the people who emphasize the geology of the world, the idea of cultural justice, or everything new is specific to the Meshach Rimfrat, are they misunderstanding that and almost forgetting? You mentioned about cost, and they keep on going on, what about Jews and Jesus? What about this? So we're losing thousands of Jews and Jesus. But 60 years ago, 70 years ago, we lost millions of Jews who rejected the news and didn't travel to Israel, didn't travel to the state, and 900 years ago, it was the same. So it's all at the cost. Because there were free market ideas. So my question is really, how can people not see that and equate the cost of not looking, of rejecting progress?
Easier for people outside to make a such a judgment. I, 5-10 years ago, was much more critical than I am today of the rabbis of 100 years ago, who, or 150 years ago, who saw the Enlightenment and instead of addressing it, sort of put the wagons together, circled the wagons and said, we're under siege, we're going to hold on to what we have, like the example you gave of the Chasam Sofer, that Hadash Sunnah Torah, that anything new is forbidden. Right? So I felt in my more militant, younger years, not that long ago, I was more certain of myself that they made a serious mistake. I'm not saying I'm better or bigger, but I felt very confident of saying that they should have done them better, and there would have been less of a cause. But as I get older, I'm less certain of myself that another option would have been more successful. The forces of history are much stronger, sociological forces, are much stronger than we've been credited for. We assume, especially as Americans, to feel we can control everything, assume that all we have to do is address the problem, and it's going to go away. We need to control it. I'm not sure. A lot of times we have a very difficult situation with a lot of imperfect solutions, imperfect exaggerations. So I'm not so sure that all they have to do is open up themselves to a cook. The Mayor Schartenkraut, as he said, in the meantime, and again, I'm not from that organization, and one of the reasons I'm not from that organization is because I agree with you in my long-term vision. But in the short term, and people like to live their lives in the short term, they're doing quite well. In other words, in terms of percentages of holding on to Jewish tradition as their parents, compared to any other sector of society, assuming that's an important thing. They're doing very well. In other things also. So again, I think it's something, I agree with you in your vision, but I don't think it's a simple vision, that they're blind and we're on target. I think it's much more complex than that. And it's appropriate to respect where they're coming from, because we feel like they have a better chance of convincing them eventually. Otherwise, yeah.
It's interesting that you say that the situation is complex. I should say that as a Roman Orthodox religious writer, I have a great deal of respect for Rav Kook and upon his inspiration and his ideas of religious orthodoxy. But one of the things I found troubling in your title, partly because I'm from the left, and partly because I don't think Reform Judaism or Judaism in general of any kind should be, you know, a completely free market where you take whatever you like. I found that worrying because of the connotations with the free market, but the way you've explained it seems inspirational. So the question I want to ask is, how do you think you overcome the fear? The fear of the fear that any expression of new ideas is going to lead to which is rather than helping you preserve tradition, going to help, you know, destroy it. How do you think you overcome that fear? Do you think it's always necessary to overcome it, or do you think you carry on anyway?
I think fear is a natural emotion, and it's appropriate to be fearful for our children, our grandchildren, our people. But at the same time, I think that great things come with courage. And the only thing that's going to overcome fear, the only thing that ever is overcome fear, is one of two things, courage or necessity. And my hope, my career is really based in inspiring people to have courage. And my great fear is that if I fail and others like me fail, then will be forced to that vision, not out of courage, but out of necessity. I'll end with that. And to remind you, this book of mine is a book that I got to